Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Given all the gloomy news about this country's financial condition, it's easy to gloss over other challenges we continue to face, among them health care. Senators Barack Obama and John McCain have both proposed ways to reform this country's health care system. Joining me to talk about the candidates' plans and their viability in the current economic climate, Leonard Berman. He's senior fellow at the Urban Institute and co-director of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. Julie Rovner is health policy correspondent for National Public Radio, and John Shields of the Lewin Group, a national health care and human services policy research and consulting firm. Throughout the hour, I look forward to hearing from you. I know many of you are concerned about health care costs rising and how we're going to pay for it in the future. So I hope you'll join us on 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Julie Rovner, I'll start with you. The stunning financial news we've had in the last few weeks has made for a very, very different presidential campaign. How does the current financial crisis change the outlook for health care in the future?
Well, according to the candidates, it doesn't change it very much, so they say. Now, one of the interesting things is, of course, you know, Barack Obama did say at one point that he might have to scale back some of his domestic plant. And indeed, his health care plan, he says, will cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $60 billion a year. He wants to take some of that money from letting the Bush tax cuts expire. But, you know, one of the dirty little secrets, I think, for both plans is that there's a lot of money that sloshes around in the health care system. We spend $2 trillion on health care a year. And probably there's enough money within that to really rework the healthcare system without getting a lot of external money, as one of my good friend health policy analyst Jeff Goldsmith said, you don't want to tell the providers who are now getting that money that that's where you're going to get it now. So neither Senator McCain nor Senator Obama has really talked about taking redistributing money from within the healthcare system, but you really could do it. Even given what else is going on externally, I think the big problem with the financial crisis is not so much the money, but the attention, is whether next year with a new president that there's going to be the time and attention to give to healthcare rather than the money.
Bring this down to a personal level, if you will. On average, what are families spending for healthcare now?
Well, it varies, but it's certainly a lot more than they were 8 years ago. I mean, healthcare has gone up a considerable amount. People are spending more out of pocket. There are 46 million Americans who have no health insurance. So that number has certainly gone up. People who have health insurance through their employer are paying more in co-pays and deductibles and out of pocket and more in premiums. So indeed, now 8-9 months ago, this was looking like the number one issue for voters. It obviously isn't anymore. Gas prices passed it. Now, obviously, the economic meltdown has passed it. But certainly, when you look into these polls, healthcare and healthcare costs remain near the top. So this is a piece of the economic concern that Americans have.
Julie Rovner, she's health policy correspondent for National Public Radio and contributing editor for National Journal's Congress Daily. Turning to you now, Leonard Berman, what are the estimates as to costs that America's uninsured put on the rest of us?
Actually, I'm not the best person to answer that. John Shields, I think, actually has that right at the tip of his fingers.
All right, John Shields.
Unfortunately, I do have the tip of my fingers. Hospitals provide a lot of free care, to patients during the year.
Yes.
Who don't have insurance, and that's about $31 billion. And there's another $20 to $25 billion that is paid for by state and local governments to run clinics or public hospitals that help the uninsured. So there's $50 billion in transfers or subs, free care, if you will, that's being provided to the uninsured. And the people who pay for that, of course, are going to be the people who have money. The people who have private insurance typically are the ones who wind up paying the cost of if a hospital has uncompensated care expenses because they treated 10 uninsured people, they have to recover those costs somehow. And the way they do it is to increase the prices they charge to other payers, usually the private payers. So we do pay for the uninsured in that sense.
Tell me, what percentage of people currently get their health insurance through their employers?
It's about 53% of the total population. That percentage, the percentage of employers offering coverage, has been dropping. So they still debate whether that means it's a reduction in employer coverage, but the percentage of employers dropping offering coverage fell from 68% in 2001, and now it's down to about 60%. And that's pretty alarming, considering that that's the primary source of coverage for most people under the age of 65.
John Shields, he's Senior Vice President of the Lewin Group, National Healthcare and Human Services Policy Research and Consulting Firm. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Now I'd like to get to each of the two plans and how they compare, contrast, and just how workable they might be. Leonard Berman, can you start with John McCain's plan?
Yeah, John McCain would eliminate the exclusion individuals get for insurance provided by an employer. Currently, if your employer provides you insurance, it's not included in your income, and you save the income tax on that. In exchange for that income tax exclusion, he would offer a refundable tax credit of $2,500 for individuals, $5,000 for family coverage. There are two advantages of that option over the current system. One is that you get that amount regardless of what tax bracket you're in, so low-income people get the same benefit as high-income people do. Also, in the near term, that's worth a lot more than what they're losing in the income tax exclusion. $5,000 would correspond to like a $20,000 family policy for a household in 25% bracket. The other thing is that credit would be available whether you get your insurance from your employer or you buy it yourself. Right now, you don't get any tax breaks if you buy insurance in the, what's called the non-group market. So that's a large subsidy for the 25 or 30 million people who currently get their insurance outside of work. The other thing he does is he says he would spend $7 to $10 billion a year on a high-risk pool, helping people whose expenses are much higher than average be able to get insurance. A big change that he would propose is he would allow insurers to compete across state lines. That sounds like a technical point, but it's really important because what it means is that some of the states regulate insurance pretty heavily. They require insurers to offer insurance to anybody who applies for it, including people who are very, very sick. But a lot of states don't. And because insurers can compete across state lines, it basically means that state regulations will become inoperative. Insurers in states that don't have any regulations will be able to pick off the healthiest people and provide them insurance at a low cost. And the people who buy insurance in states that have a lot of regulation will be the ones who are left will be the ones who are much sicker than average, and the premiums will get very, very high. That's considered to be one of the biggest concerns about this proposal.
Leonard Berman, senior fellow at the Urban Institute. He's co-director of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. Julie Robner, why is it that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and other business organizations have come out against the McCain plan? What's the problem?
Well, there's a lot of concern about the McCain plan, that it would really drive continue to push away the idea of employer-sponsored insurance. There are reasons that it would encourage more people to go into the individual market. First of all, this tax credit for people who are young and healthy would allow them to go across state lines, get much cheaper insurance in these non-regulated states, and they would then have that extra money, basically, through the tax credit. So that would encourage them to leave their more expensive employer-provided plans. There's a big concern with this idea of buying insurance across state lines, of what it would do to the risk pooling, as we call it, that people, healthy people, would gravitate to these lower cost plans, sicker people would be left in these higher cost plans. It's not just a matter of how states regulate plans, whether you have to take everyone, but also a lot of states require certain benefits to be covered. And, you know, they like to talk about, you know, oh, it's hair transplants and in vitro fertilization, but it's also things like diabetes care and, certain kinds of cancer coverage. I mean, not every state requires things that, you know, prescription drug coverage, maternity care. Some of these mandated benefits are not necessarily things that people would think of as being, you know, excessive benefits, and some states don't have those things. So there's a lot of medical groups who also say they're worried about being able to buy insurance across state lines.
Juliet Ravner, a health policy correspondent for NPR. When we come back, we'll outline Barack Obama's plan and take your calls. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. And welcome back. As we talk about both Barack Obama and John McCain, their plans for health care in the face of the current economic crisis, health care may have moved to second or third place beyond or behind the entire economic outlook. Nevertheless, we need to understand what each of these candidates is proposing. John Shields, can you tell us about the Obama plan and what he thinks he can offer?
Well, the Obama plan would start with an employer contribution requirement. The employer has to either provide insurance or pay a tax to the federal government. That would be just apply to larger firms. Small firms would be exempt. So that should encourage some employer coverage. The program
small as well as large,
yes.
Employers. Okay.
Yeah, and I think that what we expect to see, they're proposing an expansion in the Medicaid program, which is the program that covers most of the low-income people in the country. A lot of low-income people don't get coverage on the program, and he would extend it so that all low-income people are potentially eligible. He also provides premium subsidies that would be used to help people who that make too much money to be eligible for Medicaid, but they don't make enough money to be able to afford it themselves. So they would have a premium subsidy program for those people. there would also be a new national plan that they would create. This national plan would be an alternative to private coverage. It would be a public plan, which in concept it might be similar to Medicare. And people will be able to buy into that plan. The reason why people might want to is that the program may be cheaper, is likely to be cheaper than private insurance. And that's because they usually pay providers less under government programs than under private insurance.
Julie, critics of the Obama plan say his proposal greatly increases the federal regulation of private insurance, but does not address core economic incentives. What does that mean?
Well, it certainly does greatly increase the regulation of private insurance. He would do things that John McCain wouldn't do, for instance, require health plans to take people with pre-existing conditions. This, and actually, something that Len said that I should correct, and he wasn't wrong, but the McCain plan has changed, talking about people and taking these high-risk pools, people who are sick, because insurance companies under the McCain plan would be able to reject people who are sick. And they've actually now said that they would put maybe $15 or $20 billion into these special plans to let people who have pre-existing conditions get in, but several experts say that's still not nearly enough. So under the Obama plan, insurance companies would have to take you even if you have pre-existing condition.
Well, I think that a lot of people at this point, experts, think that neither plan will do very much about the real problems in the healthcare system, the things that are driving costs. Right now, when you go to a doctor, they'll perform a procedure, they'll prescribe some drugs. You don't have to pay for it because you're insured, and the doctor doesn't have to pay for it. And there's very little incentive for economic discipline there to control your health spending. And it generates a lot more utilization of health care than we think we need. And these plans don't do very much about that. McCain's plan actually comes closest to that because it arranges it so that you can get your tax credit, exactly the same tax credit, regardless of what kind of insurance you buy. So if you bought lower cost insurance, you don't lose any tax benefit by doing that. And that's one of the advantages of having the flat tax credit that they're proposing to.
Leonard Berman.
So one thing that Obama does do is he proposes to put $50 billion into measures that would lower cost in the healthcare industry, like trying to find out what procedures and medicines actually work. One of the things that's amazing about the health industry is that there's wild variation in practice across parts of the country and a lot of uncertainty about what the right treatment is in a particular situation. So actually figuring out the right thing to do could save a lot of money. And we don't really know how much, but it clearly would help.
Here's an email from Sally in Chevy Chase, who says, I think one of the biggest healthcare traps is that insurance companies exclude pre-existing conditions. At 55, everyone I know has some kind of health issue. As people move from job to job, they're required to qualify for a different employer's plan and often are bumped off the plan and forced into the expensive self-insuring marketplace. Even there, it's hard to find coverage at any price. Please comment how each of the health plans addresses pre-existing conditions. Julie.
Well, now, of course, in the group market, HIPAA, the 1996 Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, should have taken care of that. If you have coverage and you're moving from job to job in an employer's
plan. You said should have.
Yes. That if.
But.
No, you're taken care of. As long as you're going from a plan in which you have coverage to a plan in which you are getting coverage, your pre-existing condition is covered. The problem is when you're leaving, if you're self-employed or you're going to a job or you've been unemployed for more than 63 days, I believe is the cutoff. That's when you start to fall into trouble with these pre-existing conditions. And as we've noted, under the McCain plan, they would try to expand these existing high-risk pools. But I just did a piece last week that pointed out 30 states have these risk pools. They are problematic at best. Often, even if you can get in, they don't cover the condition for which you've qualified in the first place. So if you need the high-risk pool because you have cancer, they'll say, you're in, but we're not going going to cover your cancer for 6 months or a year, which is kind of a problem. So, you know, even if McCain is going to throw $20 billion at these high-risk pools, that's still a problem. Under the Obama plan, as the critics point out, yes, it's federal regulation, but the regulation will say you're going to have to cover this. On the other hand, that's going to drive up the premiums. So that's going to make the plan cost more.
And what about mental health care? I was interested to learn that one of the add-ons to the $700 billion rescue plan signed into law last weekend included a mental health parity option.
Well, the idea behind mental health parity is that you would treat that like any other illness. You wouldn't have, in many plans, you have a higher deductible or a higher copay because it's mental health care. There's a limit on the number of visits you can have. In mental health parity, there's no greater limitation on your use of mental health care than there is on any other type of health care. So if you buy a policy that has a limit on physician visits, I mean, these things exist, that limit would apply, but it would apply equally to both mental health and physical health.
Julie. If I could correct you, that wasn't an add-on to the bailout. The bailout was an add-on to it.
Gotcha. And but that's how it went through.
Yep, that's how it went through.
Leonard.
I just want to make a comment about what Julie said about HIPAA that guarantees you can get insurance. It doesn't guarantee the insurance is affordable. And if you actually look at the premiums charged for HIPAA insurance, they're much, much higher than the insurance if you have a medical exam to qualify.
But that's only if you're buying your own. If you're
I think the real issue, the real problem with this is in the non-group market, where individuals are purchasing insurance as individuals. Right. There, in all but two or three states, the insurer can decline to cover you because of health status, or they could say, "Well, I'll cover you, but I'm going to have to charge you some astronomical premium." They can charge you more. That practice is prohibited under Obama. That practice is actually permitted to continue under the McCain plan. And arguably it would become much more frequent in the McCain plan because he would be setting up these federally funded high-risk pools where insurers are really invited to take any sick individual they encounter at the door and pass them off to the federal government to cover. It's going to cost way more than what they have proposed.
All right. Suppose nothing is done. What happens, Julie?
If nothing is done, one presumes that prices, the cost of health care continues to go up at roughly 1.5 times the cost of regular inflation. Employers basically are continuing to pass the costs on to their workers if they continue to offer health care at all. What we're seeing is small businesses in particular can't afford to continue to offer health insurance. Large employers pretty much have to. The number of uninsured goes up. I mean, things are getting worse. At some point, the healthcare system, I suppose, melts down the way the credit system.
All right. We've got lots of callers waiting. We'll open the phones now and take calls from listeners around the country. First to Columbia, Missouri. Good morning, Kay. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for your show and for having me on. I want to say that I come myself from the position that we need single-payer national health care, and it could be jobbed out, like, to the states, each state to administer it. Okay, that being said, I just want to ask, if that happened, you know, what would happen to the provider industry that is out there now? And I wonder if these people have any thoughts on how far down the line we would be from being able to come to that. I guess maybe I'm on the Ted Kennedy thing, you know, of putting everybody in the country on Medicare.
I understand your concern. How far along might the thinking be toward a single-payer plan, Leonard Berman?
I don't think it's very far. I mean, Ted Kennedy's been pushing it for a long time, but I think there's a lot of concern about big government getting involved in the health market. The thing that's encouraging about this campaign is that you've got both campaigns proposing enormous amount of subsidies to really expand access to care. there are serious flaws in the proposals, especially the McCain proposal, but you can imagine there could be some common ground in which you really could add coverage to 10 or 20 million more households.
But considering the current economic crisis, panic, whatever you want to call it, is the likelihood that the next president is going to have to be so focused on what's happening there that, as we said earlier, likely nothing gets done, Julie?
I think that's the biggest concern, is that, you know, it's very hard, as I like to say, for Congress to walk and chew gum at the same time. I think one crisis at a time is the problem. And I think this is one of the things that we saw with the Clinton administration, you know, trying to do health reform. When Clinton became president, he was distracted. He had, you know, a financial stimulus bill, trying to get through a big budget reconciliation bill. He had gays in the military that sort of popped up. He didn't really get to health reform right away, and he kind of got nibbled to death. And I think that's the big concern, as we said. I think it's less sort of that there isn't going to be any money, as that you know, there's going to be a new president and a new Congress, and there's going to be other things that may be more important to deal with on the agenda.
Mm. And arguably, this is going to be third on the list, because we also have to deal with Iraq.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And to Christine in Montana, Florida. Hi there.
Hi. Diane, thanks for taking my question.
Sure.
I've been a registered nurse for 30 years, and I've done home health in Palm Beach County for several. And I know that I've seen very easy remedies for our Medicare system being so high. That said, I'm wondering, why is it our legislator, president, the candidates could push through socialized debt in 2 weeks and give us $700 billion worth of extra debt, but it's taking years to push through socialized medicine?
Isn't that an interesting question? What do you think, John Shields?
Well, you know, we've never had the uninsured march on Washington. What we need are 1 million uninsured people to march on Washington to help give some impetus to the movement.
You may just have begun that process.
1 million people. I'll be out that weekend. But the uninsured need to the plight of the uninsured needs to be put in sharper focus, and they have to show some interest in it. It was just a few years ago that 1 million undocumented Americans, immigrants, marched on Chicago. And if undocumented populations can get it together to do a protest like that, I would think it's long past due that the uninsured do something like that.
Leonard.
I think actually what'll move Congress to do something about this will be when small and medium businesses say this is killing them, the Republican base. I mean, I would hate to be a small business that wanted to offer insurance to your employees. One of them gets sick, the premiums go through the roof, you can't afford to pay it, you're going to say, well, I can't cover you because you've got cancer. That would be heartbreaking, and it could put you out of business.
All right, to Indianapolis. Hi there, Kenny. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wonder if your guest could compare and contrast both Obama and McCain's health plans in terms of somebody who's completely self-employed and pays his own insurance.
Julie.
Well, certainly, starting out, the McCain plan would be good. Although, well, I take it back, because right now, if you're self-employed and you buy your own insurance, you do get a tax break. The people who don't get tax breaks now are the people who work for someone else but have to buy their own insurance. Those are the people who get nothing. And everybody has said for years that that's just unfair. If you're self-employed and you fill out, a Schedule C, then you get to write off you get to deduct the amount of health insurance premiums that you pay. So you would get the tax credit, and that would be good. And under Obama, you would also continue to write those off. So I think it would probably be about a draw. I don't know.
John Shields.
Well, one thing that the Obama plan does is it actually creates a small employer tax credit. And for firms under 10 or 25 workers.
But he's asking about self-employed.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're self-employed and have employees, but you're talking about solo,
are you talking about, Kenny, clarify what you mean?
Well,
I'm I'm completely solo. I'm a professional musician, and I teach private music lessons, so I'm on my own.
Yeah, I don't think you're helped very much by that at all.
By what?
By the Obama plan.
Oh, you'd probably you would probably be solo would be considered small business.
Well, there are two ways you could benefit. One is you could buy into this exchange where you could probably get insurance for less than you're currently paying, especially if you have any health problems. The other thing is if your income's low enough, you'll qualify for subsidies under the Obama plan. You'd also be much better off than under current law under the McCain plan because the $5,000 credit for family coverage is much more generous than the current tax break you get.
But how will the McCain? I've heard that the McCain plan will tax you on above and beyond the $5,000 credit limit. How would that be taxed at that point?
No, but that's only if you have employer-provided insurance, which you don't.
Well, you would lose the deduction you get right now, but that's not worth as much as the credit.
All right. You can tell from our guest today how opinions on this whole health care proposal that comes either from John McCain or Barack Obama differ and will continue to change.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. By WAMU's The Conversation, with listener-generated discussions and a monthly online chat with Diane Rehm. More information at conversation.wamu.org. And by the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
10 months after 9/11, President Bush dispatched a small team of CIA counterterrorism officers and commandos to Iraq. The leader of the operation explains why he believes the Bush administration allowed their covert mission to fail. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we've got lots of questions for our guest, Leonard Berman. He's with the Urban Institute. Julie Robner, health correspondent for National Public Radio, and John Shields of the Lewin Group. Here's an email from Cynthia, who says, I have two questions. First, according to the McCain campaign website, the proposal is to give a $5,000 tax credit to families or $2,500 to individual tax filers to put toward health insurance. Suppose the family's tax bill is less than $5,000. Let's say their bill is $3,000. How then could the family get a $5,000 tax credit? Doesn't it mean that only those taxpayers who make enough money to owe more than the proposed amounts could benefit? Leonard.
There are two things. One is if your health insurance premium was less than $5,000, the difference goes into a health savings account. So you still get the benefit of the credit. The other thing is that...
Your own personal savings account?
It's called a health savings account. It's a special account. If you take the money out to use for health care, it's not taxed. The other thing is that it's a refundable tax credit, which is a technical term, but it basically means you get the full value of the credit even if you don't have any tax liability. So if you had $2,000 in taxes due and you qualified for the $5,000 credit, government would send you a check for the difference, the $3,000 over and above your tax. The nice thing about this is that the benefit is shared equally. It doesn't depend on your income level like the current tax benefits for health insurance.
All right, here's the second question she has. She says, I understand part of the McCain proposal is to tax as employee income the contribution an employer makes to the employee's health care. For example, if my salary is $40,000 a year, my employer kicks in $10,000 a year for my health care benefits, I would owe income taxes on a total of $50,000. Is my understanding correct, Julie?
That's absolutely correct. And that's the idea. And that has been the big fight about, and I think as Len has so well demonstrated in a paper that he's written, that for most people they would do better because the taxes that they would pay would be more than offset by the credit. But over time, because the credit, at least so we're led to understand, doesn't go up as fast as healthcare costs do, over time the credit would be worth less and less. Healthcare costs would presumably keep going up, that over time people probably wouldn't do as well.
Okay. I think the value of the tax credits that they're going to provide are about two times, a little more than twice, what people would pay in taxes if they counted their benefits as income for tax purposes. So they're putting a lot of money into these credits, and although it's pretty daunting, and you're probably going to be better off.
And here's an email from Corey here in D.C., who says, are we ignoring the elephant in the room, the Medicare program? Medicare faces serious financial challenges, although some of Medicare's problems reflect those in the health system as a whole. Medicare's challenges need to be addressed. What would the candidates do with respect to shoring up Medicare? John Shields.
Well, they've been very nonspecific about Medicare thus far, and that's because they're looking at health reform plans, and they don't want to get the aged population upset with them, obviously, by trying to pay for these programs out of Medicare or Medicaid cuts. It turns out, though, last Sunday it was announced by the McCain campaign that they actually do intend to cut the Medicare program and the Medicaid program by about $1.6 trillion over 10 years. That is equal to about 14% of what we'll spend in the next 2 years on those two programs. That's an awful lot to take out of the program.
McCain has been more specific about the Medicare program even before this, and this has to do with whether or not these cuts have to do with whether or not the tax credits pay for themselves. But McCain has had some interesting things to say about the Medicare program. He wants to use the Medicare program as a way to change. We talked earlier about these incentives, that there's no incentives to cut costs. Right now, you know, the main incentive is to try to load more of the cost responsibility onto the patients in hopes that the patients will seek out less care. One of the things that McCain has proposed that really is kind of interesting is to use Medicare as a way to sort of change the way we pay providers, to urge them to have better outcomes, to sort of bundle care, and really this sort of buzzword, pay for performance, but actually, you know, get them to improve their outcomes, pay for better outcomes. And we have seen this in the past, that when Medicare changes how it pays, that other private payers tend to follow. And there's really an emphasis on this. It is pretty sort of far-reaching, and there is a fairly detailed proposal for doing that in Medicare, which really could change, you know, have a downward pressure, possibly increase quality and decrease cost. So that is there in the McCain plan.
To Hendersonville, Tennessee. Good morning, Lawrence.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Something just has to be done. I am doing well. My wife has great insurance. I'm self-employed, so we're
not having a problem. But I just got a call last night from my sister. One of our distant relatives was rushed to the hospital in a small town in Tennessee called Erin. The local hospital there rejected her because she did not have insurance. She had to drive another 30 minutes to the next hospital in Dixon, Tennessee. There she was rejected as well for not having insurance. She finally ended up in a Clarksville, Tennessee hospital where they did treat her in the emergency room. But to no avail, she died during treatment due to organ failure. And I just think that that's reprehensible. If we are able to go into debt of $700 billion to bail out the greatest of us and choose wars that we don't have to engage in and go into debt for that, I think the greatness of a nation is measured by how they treat the least of those of us. And I think that we should be able to come up with some plan. I think your guest, Mr. Furman, said earlier that the government is already spending about $50 billion total per year on the uninsured by, you know, subsidizing health clinics and hospitals for the uninsured care they give. And Obama's plan is supposed to cost $60 billion a year. I don't know why we just don't shift that money into some type of group plan for all the uninsured left over in America.
Lawrence, I'm so sorry to hear that story. That's really just, as you say, reprehensible. Julie, what can you say about this idea that hospitals in this day and age are refusing people who clearly are deathly ill because they have no insurance?
Well, the first thing I can say is that it's illegal. There's a federal law that people who are hospitals must treat people. They must be stabilized regardless of their insurance status if they're
supposed to be.
Yes,
but still,
I know
Lawrence's
story. No, I absolutely believe the story. I'm only saying that hospitals who take Medicare and Medicaid are required to treat people with emergency conditions and stabilize them.
Is there going to be, in the face of this $700 billion bailout, an echo of Lawrence's statement, if this nation can do that to bail out the richest, why is it the nation cannot take hold of a fair plan that would cover everybody? Leonard Berman.
I mean, one would hope. I think one of the best things that could come out of this financial catastrophe, which has really caused real pain throughout the economy, is that it could cause a reassessment of our priorities, a reassessment of free market ideology, which, you know, I think has actually contributed to a lot of the health problems, and thinking about what the role of government is and how you can make sure that, you know, people who are working can live with dignity. One of the striking things about the uninsured is that almost all of them are working. People who are very, very poor are covered by public programs. These are working people, and they just can't afford.
You know, on Thursday morning in our second hour, we are planning a program on capitalism. It's going to be a tough show to do, but I think the time has come to sort of re-examine, as you say, our priorities and considering what's happening with the world and the markets and the wars. Where do we go from here? John?
Well, many of the plans, we've looked at a lot of health reform plans, ones that achieve universal coverage. Usually the best of them cost another $100 billion in federal spending. The question is, where are we going to get that $100 billion a year in spending? There's only one place to get it, and you have to go to people who have money. And that means some kind of taxation in the system.
Where did we just get $700 billion?
Our grandchildren are going to pay for that. We're not going to pay for it. And I don't think we can look at a program like healthcare as something where we're going to have our children pay for it. Fine, if we have an emergency, a national emergency, we have to borrow money. But this is an ongoing need for this country, and we just have to be willing to provide the resources to do that. There's a lot about both plans here that attempts to reduce costs. They both have some good ideas. And frankly, I think we need them all. You could put them in the same plan, frankly, but to make it as efficient as possible. But it's very difficult. You're going to, the people who are uninsured, a lot of them are lower income. They might be able to pay something for their coverage, but you just can't. You're just not going to be able to require them to pay $12,000 a year for family
coverage.
Let's
go to Syracuse, New York. Good morning, Lucy.
Good morning, Diane. Good morning, panel. I have a quick statement and then a quick question.
Sure.
Doctors have what's called usual and customary fees that they charge for a certain procedure. And all this means is the doctors get together and decide what they're going to charge for, for example, a gallbladder removal. Now, this is fine, but the only problem is there's no true competition among doctors. Now, under John McCain's plan, he's saying you can go across the state lines and buy an insurance policy. What is to keep insurance companies from banding together and saying we are going to keep our premiums around the same cost? And this way, it's a win-win situation for all of us. Nobody, the consumer really doesn't win. Ultimately, we stay in business. Can you answer that question for me, please?
Julie.
Well, for starters, doctors aren't allowed to get together and decide what their fees are. That would be collusion. It's illegal.
Lucy, I'm interested that you said that. What makes you think that?
Because when I call my insurance company, I'll say to them, why is it one doctor, the doctors charge around the same price for the same things? And they do get together. It is a fact. I have physicians in my family. They certainly do get together and say, well, you know, what do you charge for this? They ask each other, and they come up with the same usual and customary fee that's allowed to be charged.
Well, it is illegal, as Julie has just said.
Well, and it's the insurance company that determines what the usual and customary fee is and determines what they allow to be charged, basically.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. John Shields.
Well, I'm sorry,
You wanted to say something in regard to price fixing?
I think that a lot of the price fixing that you see in the economy, you'll see it with, for a while we were seeing it in the airline industry. You call two places and you get the same cost for the same flight. That kind of thing can happen when you have very few carriers. Or in healthcare, it can happen when you have very few insurers in an area. And one of the things we're finding today is that there's been a lot of consolidation in insurance, which one worries is going to actually reduce the amount of competition out there.
Leonard.
One thing that's odd about the health market is that competition among insurers doesn't actually always work out to the public's benefit. You know, I mean, if you talk about cars, you know, the price gets driven down, you can get a cheaper car, it's a good thing. For insurance, the incentive for insurers is to try to pick off the healthiest people, provide them insurance at a low cost, they could still make money on it, and then people who are sick are just left high and dry. What you need is some kind of, this is what I was alluding to before when I talked about free market ideology. You need some kind of a referee. You need somebody to say that you need to come up with a way to cover people who have health problems, especially if the government is spending billions or trillions of dollars in subsidies.
All right. Last caller to John in Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning to you.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just like to say I'm not tired, but why only every 4 years we talk about Medicare and Medicare when nothing is done? And I don't know if we can do it, but can we just learn something from Canada, which is next door neighbor, or Germany, who have full coverage for every single person? And thank you.
Thank you very much.
We've looked at that pretty closely. The Canadian system could be imitated here by simply saying we'll cover everyone under Medicare. Just lower the eligibility age from 65 to zero. And you got to give it a lot of credit for its simplicity. Everyone can understand that. These plans we're talking about are complicated. They're trying to build on the existing system. That's what's making them complicated.
So where is the resistance to that kind of Canadian or German plan?
Well, you know, they've had this up for referendum in California a few years ago. Only 17% of the population wanted to do it. They had a referendum in Oregon, and they got a very similar result. And people are very afraid of getting into a system where there's a lot of big government. So what I've always thought would probably be a better way of thinking about it is perhaps to have a system that collects all the money we need to pay for care, make sure that everybody gets an opportunity to have insurance, and then go ahead and let people pick from private insurance plans. That's almost what they do in Germany.
That's collect what they do the money. In Switzerland.
Yeah, and Switzerland and Netherlands, I'm told, they bring in the money. People, it's based on your ability to pay. Then people pick their insurance. There are a couple of 13 nonprofit funds they can pick from in Germany. And they have essentially the same kind of coverage you and I have.
Leonard.
We could afford to pay for universal coverage. We're the richest country in the world. We're the only rich country that doesn't provide it. You know, we can squeeze waste out of the system, or we could raise taxes. But if it's a priority, we could do it.
It does seem to me, going back to John Scheel's suggestion, we need a million-person march on Washington for health care. I thank you all so much for joining us, Leonard Berman of the Urban Institute, Julie Rovner of NPR, and John Scheels of the Lewin Group. Let's hope something gets done. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.